Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We will first go to New Orleans where ALEC is meeting, that is the American Legislative Exchange Council, a corporate manufactured front group that is coordinating corporate-friendly legislation for passage in state houses and the Capitol. Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, joins us. A blueprint of ALEC's legislative onslaught of 800 bills was leaked to her, and we will discuss today's gathering of corporate whores in the prostitution-friendly Big Easy. Then we'll examine the darkening clouds of an impending perfect storm of economic calamity as prominent Wall Streeters predict a double-dip recession and cascading municipal defaults, while the bond markets slam Spain and impale Italy. David Ruscio, professor of economics at Notre Dame, joins us to discuss what looks like our Smoot-Hawley moment, where instead of rescuing the economy, the Congress has dug a grave for it. Then Lako Tongan joins us. He is recently back from his native southern Sudan, the world's newest country, where UN peacekeepers have just been killed on the disputed northern border. We'll get his analysis of how war can be avoided with the North, which has just ceded one-third of its territory to the oil-rich South and is led by a general who has been indicted for genocide by the International Criminal Court. I'm now joined by Lisa Graves, who is Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. The Center for Media and Democracy has recently made public a data dump from the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, detailing over 800 model bills that have been used for regressive legislation. You may find them at alecexposed.org. Lisa Graves is currently in New Orleans, where ALEC is holding its annual conference. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you for having us on. We appreciate it.
And tell me about today's gathering, because I understand what is happening there is that this group, which is a tax-exempt foundation, because its status is, with the IRS is being challenged by Common Cause, it's a group of some of the biggest corporations in the country, like Walmart, Coca-Cola, Coke Industries, AT&T, Altria, ExxonMobil, etc. And they essentially, their executives essentially sit side by side with state legislatures, legislators, and they basically give them their blueprint and their walking instructions. Is that?
Well, it's extremely troubling. What we know is happening here in New Orleans is that ALEC legislators, state legislators, are going to be voting on efforts to change the law, blueprints to change the law in states across the country, and they'll be voting along with corporations, representatives from some of the biggest corporations in the world, on these blueprints to change the law. And it's certainly the case, in our view, that this is an extraordinary amalgam of corporations and politicians. It's basically a marriage of corporations and politicians. And what has happened before we were able to make these documents available to the public is that these legislators would come home to their home states after a nice vacation at a luxury resort where they were sort of wined and dined along with corporate heads of industry, and they would come home to their home states and introduce bills without disclosing at all that they had previously voted on them and that corporations had pre-approved them by voting on them in these ALEC task forces. They were cleansed of any reference to ALEC, cleansed of any reference to the fact that corporations had pre-voted on them through the ALEC task forces, and introduced as if they were a legislator's own good idea.
So far, ALEC has invested nearly $400 million in state elections, and it seems to be a three-stage strategies. The ALEC and the corporations and their lobbyists write the legislation. Then they work with the legislatures, and then they put the company's muscle behind the legislation in these state capitals, and then they go ahead and invest millions of dollars to elect and re-elect the legislatures who worked with them.
Well, the report that you mentioned that Common Cause has released today does show that that ALEC corporations have spent at least $370 million in state election campaigns over the last several years. And I think that that characterization of this multi-step process is pretty generally accurate. They these corporations work behind the scenes through their lobbyists to create the bills, to write the bills. They then vote on those bills within the ALEC task forces. Some of these corporations then also have their own lobbyists go to the state and push for those bills, although quite frankly, once those legislators have already voted for the legislation, they're basically like super lobbyists for the corporation. They certainly don't need to be lobbying that member anymore, the member who voted for it. They may be lobbying other members in the state to pass that legislation, and it certainly is the case that these same ALEC corporations then invest enormous sums in politicians. Some of these corporations do give donations to both parties, but they tend, for the most part, to give more money to the politicians that are pushing their agenda, which I suppose is to be expected, except for that this whole process seems to be a real institutionalization of a corruption of the democratic process, because the United States is supposed to be a country in which the democracy that we've made is of, by, and for the people, not the corporations.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She is talking to us from New Orleans, where ALEC is holding its annual conference. And I understand that a part of what is going on there in New Orleans is that the ALEC is conducting workshops about pension reform, privatization of Medicaid, and even benefits of CO2, which most of the educated and sentient world recognizes as the cause of global warming.
Well, you know, they have this sort of public piece of their operation in which they have presentations that people who pay to attend the conference or are reporters can observe, in which there's this sort of indoctrination about their agenda, whether it's on pensions, public employee pensions, and privatizing those, or whether it's on other parts of their privatization agenda, and including, as you point out, this session that was named "Warming Up to Climate Change." We have documented that was the title of the session. Since they've received some criticism of that, they've basically described it as a cost-benefit analysis of climate change. But quite clearly, they were intending on having a session called "Warming Up to Climate Change: The Benefits of Increasing CO2 in the atmosphere for Corporations." I don't think that's probably just limited to air conditioning corporations, but it was quite an astonishing sort of brazen title for their panel.
And I mentioned that Common Cause has asked the IRS to look into the 501c3 nonprofit tax-exempt status of ALEC, because of all of the big heavy-hitting corporations, I think about 22 of them, that make up this so-called private enterprise board. And clearly, they are not, you know, the rule for a 501c3 is that you can educate but not advocate. And if you are passing legislation, paying for politicians and paying them off, that is not an educational process by any stretch of the imagination. But much of the information seems to be coming out of Minnesota, right? Isn't that where the Common Cause first sort of got an angle on what was going on there, where dozens of corporations are paying millions of dollars a year to write business-friendly legislation that essentially, I think in Minnesota alone, ALEC donated $141 million to campaigns and candidates since 2001.
So I'm not sure about the Minnesota statistics, but I do know that Minnesota today, along with the national release of that data, did go into more detail about the spending in the state. I believe it's definitely in the millions of dollars that have been spent by these corporations. to influence elections under election law, in essence, to be able to make those donations. But what I think is happening here is that people are connecting the dots. They're connecting the dots between corporations spending money in the campaigns, and then also corporations basically pushing their agenda through ALEC and having tremendous success, quite frankly, in really rewriting our laws behind the scenes without people really realizing what's been happening. And on the point that you raise about the lobbying, when you look at the bylaws of ALEC that were published in 2007, they make it quite clear that state legislators who are the chairman, the so-called state chairman of ALEC, have a duty, that's their language, they have a duty to introduce these model bills in the state houses that they represent in that state. And that's a duty to introduce bills, to get them passed. And so Common Cause has laid out a very detailed complaint, in essence, detailing the bylaws, detailing some of the documents that they've obtained through open records laws that talk about pushing legislation, lobbying for legislation. And so that's why they've asked the IRS to look into whether this group should be receiving tax-exempt donations from corporations. Basically, corporations are writing off the money, are able to write off the money they give to ALEC because it supposedly, purportedly, and on its own, in its own claims, is not engaged in lobbying, doesn't have any lobbyists. And yet it describes itself otherwise as a group that has been extremely successful in getting its model bills introduced and enacted in states across the country. And so I think that's the genesis of the allegations that Common Cause is making. And if you think about it, these corporations they're not making tax-deductible donations to the politicians. Those politicians are getting, campaign donations in pretty significant sums for those state races. But then also these corporations are making significant donations to ALEC, and those are tax-deductible.
So I guess that would be it's a stretch then for ALEC, particularly in New Orleans, to claim that they're just the piano player in the whorehouse, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know precisely about that analogy in terms of their full role, but I would say that the idea that this should just be business as usual. There's nothing to see here. Don't be concerned. That sort of PR message is a bit troubling because I think many Americans from all political parties have a general recognition that corporations have too much power in our political process. They have too much influence in the laws and regulations, that their money is really influencing things more than the voices of ordinary people. But this takes it to a whole new level to know, quite frankly, that that this whole process of ALEC is structured to give corporations, quote, a voice and a vote.
Well, we know how beleaguered corporations are, and how little groups like Acorn afflict them, and the poor dears, they had to scrape together $400 million, to get this kind of access. They really had to work hard. The whole thing is so ridiculously transparent and so absurd. And I, frankly, Lisa Graves, I was always frustrated with the hearings that they had, confirmation hearings they had for Supreme Court justices, because nobody ever asked these justices ever what their attitudes were to corporations. And it turns out that the Supreme Court now is almost dominated by corporatists, and they have passed legislation. They've applied the First Amendment to corporations now. They're working on the Fourth and the Fifth. as persons in law, because they don't have the personal responsibility that we all have, you know, and they can unload unlimited amounts of money with no transparency. We've seen that happen. So this seems to be the legislative adjunct of the corporate capture of the judicial branch.
Well, I would agree with you. You know, the fact is that the corporations are getting huge bang for their buck. Alec's own budget is between $6 and $7 million a year. Some of these corporations pay $7,500 or $25,000. Sometimes they might pay $100,000 to sponsor something for Alec. That's a lot of money to ordinary people. It's not a lot of money to some of these mega corporations. And they have tremendous return on investment for these donations to Alec, as well as the millions in donations that are going directly into those political campaigns. As someone who was the chief counsel on nominations for the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee during the first term of President Bush, I can tell you that we did ask a number of questions of some of the members, some of the nominees for judgeships about putting their thumb on the scale of justice on the side of corporations. But unfortunately, I do share your sorrow, I suppose, at the fact that the Supreme Court hearing process, which I was not involved in, did not press John Roberts and others on their views on corporations in a way that would have revealed their agenda. And it's quite clear from the Citizens United case, that's the name of the case that the right wing pushed up to the Supreme Court. It's quite clear that this Supreme Court has an extreme view, an extreme and radical view that corporations should be entitled to equal rights under our Constitution, that they are entitled to full rights under the First Amendment to influence our elections, that they should be able to spend unlimited money from their vast treasuries to influence the elections of people in our democracy. And that is a truly radical move. It is dramatically changing our political landscape in the country, and I think many Americans disagree with that decision. We certainly do at the Center for Media and Democracy. And as you said, this ALEC effort is sort of another side of this coin in terms of the extraordinary and excessive influence of corporations on our public policy in this country. And that's why one of the reasons why we felt it was imperative to make these documents available on our site, alecexposed.org.
And it's worth pointing out, Lisa Graves, just in closing here, that ALEC is active in all 50 state capitals. They have 1,800 legislators signed up and about 300 private sector members, most of whom belong to the biggest corporations in the country, like Walmart, Coca-Cola, Coke Industries, AT&T, ExxonMobil, etc. They conduct these boot camps, as they did down in North Carolina for the assembly members. This is not your grandfather's Rotary Club.
This is most certainly not. At one point last year, I think that Alec sent some press releases out saying that they were just like the YMCA. They're not like the YMCA. As you point out, this is really a concentration of some of the richest, biggest corporations on the planet who are exercising extraordinary influence behind the scenes to rewrite our laws, to rewrite the rights of Americans, to expand their power, to limit regulation of these corporations, whether it's on pollution or injuring Americans or other citizens abroad. Basically to rewrite the law, to tilt the balance, to tip the scale in their favor, and to do so behind the scenes with the assistance of willing legislators at the state level in every single state in the country. It is an astonishing development and one that the American people need to wake up to what's really going on here.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Lisa Graves.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on.
A pleasure. Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who is Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. The Center for Media and Democracy have recently made public a data dump from the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, detailing over 800 model bills that have been used for regressive legislation. You may find them at alecexposed.org. Lisa Graves is currently in New Orleans, where ALEC is holding its annual conference. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not there's a perfect storm gathering for a great economic calamity.
To me, it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is David Ruscio, who's professor of economics at Notre Dame University. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, and his latest, which will be out soon, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Ruscio.
It's good to be back with you.
And David, I'm beginning to have a terrible sort of sinking feeling that there's an impending perfect storm of economic calamity gathering. When you have Wall Streeters like PIMCO's Bill Gross saying that the economy is at a tipping point at stall speed like an airplane, and Meredith Whitney saying we are heading for a double-dip recession and municipal bond defaults are just beginning to cascade, and with the bond market slamming Spain and Italy, and then, of course, into this maelstrom steps the president who co-signed his own suicide pact with the Republicans, who now say they got 98% of what they wanted from the debt deal. So it feels to me like we're in a kind of Smoot-Hawley moment, where instead of digging us out of an impending economic collapse, we're digging the hole deeper.
It's a good analogy. My analogy is a little bit different, although roughly the same period, and that's 1937-38. That's when FDR was persuaded to, quote, do the responsible thing and cut back on government expenditures. And, of course, the economy was sent into a second tailspin, never having recovered from the depths of the Depression that began in 1929. I think that's where we are right now. The economy is on the shakiest of foundations. As you say, the bond vigilantes are back now against Spain and Italy in Europe, and austerity policies are being imposed elsewhere, from England to Greece. Unemployment continues to be very high in the United States. There are now, 26 million people who either don't have a job or don't have a full-time job and would like a full-time job. And now the latest. So Obama gives away the store. The Tea Party is in full swing in Washington. And I guess, what is it? The Mad Hatter's in power? This is insane. Insane from just the most mainstream perspective. This is... Let me explain. One, there is no problem of a debt in the United States. The United States has no problem paying off its debt. And even if there were, and I disagree with that idea, but even if there were, even if somebody wants to argue that there's a problem of growing indebtedness of the United States, this is exactly the wrong time to attempt to do anything about it. So that's what we have. We have the Mad Hatter in control of policy in Washington.
Well, in effect, what the Tea Party is doing is telling the world, don't buy our T-bills, which is beyond being destructive and criminally negligent, I think. But instead of running against the Smoot-Hawley sort of know-nothings, the president's joining them in trashing the government and talking about dysfunctional government. And in a sense...
And why don't blame it all on the Tea Party? Excuse me for interrupting.
Go ahead.
I think... Yes, the Tea Party is important, and I think there are lots of things that we have to analyze there, including holding economic policy hostage in this case. And so the great compromiser steps in order to be, quote, responsible, just as I say FDR was in 1937. But we also can't forget that Obama, from the very beginning, also made lots of noise about the deficit. And once he did, because remember, that was the key idea behind healthcare reform. not to create universal health care, not to create a single payer or a single provider plan, but to rein in health care costs. And a lot of that had to do with the federal deficit, to appointing the deficit commission. Once Obama and his economic advisors did that, the game was lost. That was the setup for the Tea Party to walk in and hold economic policy hostage.
And David Ruscio, why did he do that? I spoke yesterday with Michael Lind, who's arguing, of course, that the Tea Party is actually a Southern party, and it's their brinkmanship is an example of the kind of hardball Southern politics. And he suggested that the president's actually a Rockefeller Democrat, that it's not that the president had poor strategy. It's the president actually got what he wanted. It's just that liberal and progressive Democrats don't get it.
Well, I agree. I think Obama and company did get what they wanted. I think they actually do believe that there's a problem of the deficit. I do think they believe there's a problem of the costs surrounding health care, and that's what corporations were concerned about, and that's why health care reform got put on the agenda in the United States. I think they got exactly. So it's a kind of absurd theater that we've been watching, in which it's portrayed to us as a determined, hostage-taking, what did Biden say, terrorist Tea Party, and the president being the responsible one, when in fact they agree on the bottom line. They agree that there is a problem. That's what I disagree with. And the only thing they disagree about is how one deals with it. That's the charade that's taking place right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Notre Dame Professor of Economics, David Ruscio. We happen to be speaking, David, on the 30th anniversary of Ronald Reagan shutting down the air traffic controllers, PATCO union, which he busted. Interesting enough, in terms of the FAA and the airline world, here we have a situation where the $1 billion of revenue can't be collected because of the Republicans playing hardball in the Senate, where essentially what they're trying to do is reverse the rule to benefit Delta Airlines and help them in their union busting. So give us a perspective then on where we've come.
Well, to tie it back to this discussion, I mean, it is important that we're talking about this on this anniversary, because if we think about the point you began with, is there a chance of a double-dip recession? The fact is, the recession never went away for the majority of people. There has, in fact, been a recovery, but only a recovery for the tiny minority. And one of the reasons that unemployment is so high, that wages have not budged, the people are working longer hours, is precisely because we're at the bottom of a 40-year cycle of trade unions in the United States. And that, for me, is part of the explanation for the Tea Party. We literally have no institutions left in which people can express their outrage at what's happened over the course of the past 3 years. That those responsible for the economic crisis are those who have most benefited, who have paid nothing, and the rest of us are the ones who are paying and getting no relief, and conditions are only going to get worse given the economic decisions being made right now.
But David Ruscio, if you have a situation where the citizen and the consumer has essentially no representation in Washington, which I think is a fair assessment, and that money rules Washington.
Right.
My sense is that the citizens simply can't whine, and particularly the Democrats who are now licking their wounds over this sense of betrayal in the last week. There's a simple solution to reversing the power of money over the power of votes, and that is to start voting. And, you know, I mean...
But to start voting, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in a democracy, that's how decisions get made. There are two problems there. One problem is a problem of organization. The other is a problem of leadership. If people don't hear alternative ideas, precisely the kinds of things that they hear on your program, if people don't find alternative institutions, they take a while to build up. So to give you a comparison, look at what's happening in Greece. Now, they didn't win, right? Austerity policies have still been imposed, but there was a lot of determined opposition within Greece. as there is in Spain and elsewhere in Europe, precisely because institutions exist, trade unions exist, student organizations exist, alternative political parties exist, precisely what is missing in the United States right now.
But I think
that's the next thing that's going to be on the agenda in the United States. I think that's the political solution.
Well, I was going to add to that, though, David. I think what the Europeans have is more political intelligence. By that, I mean that they vote for politicians who provide government services. They understand the simple transaction. You pay your taxes, you get your government services. And here, people are distracted, and the Tea Party, after all, is merely a distraction or one of many. They're distracted by all kinds of extraneous things and social issues. And there isn't, I refer to it as political intelligence, this is perhaps a better way to put it. But how do you inculcate or introduce a new form of political intelligence where instead of saying, oh, we get taxed too much, which is not true, starting to sort of have talk about, well, what do we get back for our taxes? And hey, wait a minute, what little we get back for our taxes, Social Security and Medicare, they're trying to take that away from us now.
Right, right. So part of our responsibility, you, me, others, is precisely to burst the myths. In other words, we have to step forward and say, here are the deals that are being struck. They're rotten deals for the majority of the population. A tiny minority benefits precisely on the issue of taxes, to take a concrete example. The United States is not an overtaxed nation. The United States has an overall tax rate that is much lower than any of the other countries. Or any of the other industrialized countries.
It's about 30-something, isn't it, in tax to GDP?
Right. And so, and the average in the OECD, if you take it as taxes as a percentage of national income, in the OECD, it's about, 35%. The United States is much lower than that. It's below 30%. It's below what it was in the mid-1960s. So to listen to the rhetoric from economists, from politicians, and not just the Tea Party, the so-called mainstream, one would think that the United States is facing this mammoth tax burden. That's not the case. Now, it is interesting that as that tax burden has fallen, certain groups have been able to shift the tax burden from themselves to others. So right now, we have the lowest effective corporate tax rate that we've had in 40 years. So corporate taxes on corporate profits, are the lowest that they've been in 40 years. The same thing on wealthy individuals. They've been able to shift the tax burden onto the middle class. And guess who supports the Tea Party? The middle class and the upper middle class, who both aspire to be wealthy, right? So they aspire to have those low tax rates. But they're the ones whose incomes are remaining relatively constant, who are paying higher and higher taxes. Somebody has to step in and explain that. And they're not getting that from the mainstream thinkers in the United States. They're not getting that from mainstream politicians. That's what has to be reversed.
So, David Ruscio, then that explains why middle class and working Americans campaign essentially on behalf of billionaires to get tax breaks for billionaires and at the same time to give up their own health benefits, their own pension benefits, and their own Social Security.
Exactly. That was the basis of the property tax rebellion back in the 1970s, and that's the basis of this nonsense about, first of all, about being afraid of the deficit, and second of all, dealing with the deficit, not by raising additional revenues, but rather by cutting expenditures, thereby making the overall economic pattern in the United States worse, but especially that for the majority of the population. That's the insanity right now.
Well, given that I just began our conversation, David Ruscio, again, Notre Dame professor of economics, talking about Bill Gross at PIMCO, who's the big bond guru, Meredith Whitney, the municipal bond guru, mm-hmm. both saying, he's saying that we're like an airplane, we're at stalling speed and we could crash. And she's saying there is a double dip recession. The idea that this realization, which I think you can add to that too, Martin Feldstein at Harvard, they're starting to come out in the zeitgeist, literally a couple of days after this absurdity on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is, how quickly does the Pavlovian lesson come about, or buyer's remorse on the part of Americans who support both president and the Republicans, because that's the tragedy here, that the president and the Republicans both own this catastrophe and this obscenity that they've just voted on.
Right. So, but the problem is the following. The problem is not just to say that there might be a double dip recession. The problem is to analyze why that came about. Why did we have the crash of 2008? And why are we going to get a double dip recession now? And that's what the bond traders and Feldstein and others refuse to recognize, right? Because they refuse to say that a tiny minority made the decisions that created the crash of 2008 and a tiny minority who are benefiting from the economic policies right now. If you look at the stock market, not necessarily in the last week, but over the course of the last year and a half to 2 years, if you look at corporate profits, especially profits for banks, they're the ones who are walking away with the lion's share. Right? That's the analysis that has to be done, and very few people are doing that analysis. Right? That's why people are frustrated. So they're looking around. They're looking for intellectual leadership. They're looking for political leadership, and they're not finding it.
Well, you know, they're not going to find it in the mainstream press because, you know, in part, I think, due to this ridiculous binary notion that everything is equal and opposite and this fair and balance canard, where you have the pro-argument and the con-argument and somehow you end up with this sort of meaningless mush. They were incapable, the mainstream press was incapable of saying that it was the Republicans who engineered this economic hostage crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, they couldn't say it because that's not fair and balanced. That's how pathetic our discourse is, that you can't even call it as it is.
And they're not getting it from my colleagues in the universities. They're not getting it from the paid intellectuals of this society. So what they're getting are messages every single day in the form of white papers and in the form of press releases and so on from right-wing think tanks. They're the ones who are carrying the burden of opinion-making in the United States, and they're the ones who are winning the battle.
Well, they're organized, you know.
Absolutely.
If you do any of the sort of connecting of the dots, invariably it's the Koch brothers that show up. You know, we just preceded you with talking about ALEC down in New Orleans having their big convention, you know, which is, you know, about the corporatization of politics. Of course, we know about the corporatization of the Supreme Court, which has basically opened the door to this extraordinary avalanche of money that's already infecting a completely mercenary polity. Well, just in closing, David Ruscio, can we come up with any kind of strategy here? I feel like a voice in the wilderness because I'm on a very, you know, small network that's, you know, largely stifling in its own footprint through its own weird and lunatic far-left circular firing squad stuff. So I'm not encouraged being here in the middle of what goes for the American left. There's no encouragement. They're all sort of navel-gazing and talking about Ralph Nader or the Peace and Freedom Party, and that's clearly not going to get us out of this hole. What can you leave us with here?
What I can leave you with is two things. One is a responsibility. I am an academic, and it's no more encouraging to see my colleagues and their failure to articulate a way of thinking about the world in which people can begin to imagine an alternative, right? But that's clearly one of the things that needs to be done. It needs to be done patiently. A lot of people need to do it. It needs to be done over a long period of time. That's precisely the lesson you learn from the right. They have been doing it. The left has not been doing that important hard work. The other lesson is a lesson of history, which is that things change when you least expect it. You know, this is the example I give to my students is the 1960s. If you went to Berkeley in 1962, 1963, you would not have imagined anything changing. And within 2 years' period of time, you had a free speech movement and the beginning of what we now call the new left of the 1960s. The same is true of the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and so on and so forth. No one imagined them at the time, and yet we know when people are beaten down, as they are being right now, that new ideas, new forms of organization emerge. And so one of the things we have to do is keep alive the idea that something is seriously wrong right now. The only way it gets changed is by serious, basic structural change, and both, as I said before, political organizations and political leadership emerge in order to lead that battle.
But just to touch on the idea of how the right have organized, and we know the heritage in Cato and American Enterprise Institute. We also know that they're funded by big corporations like Coors and the Koch brothers.
Right.
There's no money on the left except, you know, one or two philanthropists. So
yeah, but the left has always done it without a whole lot of money. That's not the issue. What the left has is not a lot of corporate money. The left has a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That's always been our strength.
Right. Well, that's why I feel so distressed about Pacifica. It should be the network of the left that's inspiring the left and building a movement instead of peddling nonsense and conspiracy and
right.
self-marginalization and becoming the Tea Party of the left.
Well, exactly. And I mean, you know, there is a disease on the left. Listen, the left has no monopoly on craziness. We certainly have our fair share. But that gets shaken out. I mean, it's not serious stuff, and I actually don't worry about that a whole hell of a lot.
But
we do have a responsibility. You have a responsibility. I do. Our friends do. And in all honesty, there are millions of people out there who are working in social services, who are working in schools, who are working in trade unions, who are ready to do something different. Right now, they don't have a way of expressing that.
Well, I appreciate the conversation, David Riccio.
Thanks very much, and I hope we continue it.
Definitely. Again, I've been speaking with David Riccio, a professor of economics at Notre Dame University. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday, Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, and his latest out soon, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be joined by Laiko Tongan, who's just back from a brand new country he witnessed the birth of. Stay tuned.
Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki.
Oh God, oh God.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Laiko Tongan, who is a professor of international and intercultural studies and political science at Pitzer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, where he witnessed his Independence Day firsthand. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laiko Tongan.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And you, of course, were there for the declaration of statehood for the Republic of South Sudan on July the 9th. And prior to that and subsequent to that, of course, have been tensions on the border in the disputed area of Abyei, which the UN sent in peacekeepers from Ethiopia, 4,200 strong. And now there have been four of them killed. So this doesn't bode well.
That is true. First of all, let me say that the occasion that the witness of independence, the declaration of independence of South Sudan, was an event, basically, that vindicated many of us who have been fighting for that day to come. And so we have a new country, we have a new nation, and certainly there are problems that this nation is going to confront, especially
Obama for who he was. I would have voted for Cynthia McKinney. I would have appreciated her being on the scene.
What happened there? Do we still have Laiko?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. Go ahead. Somebody must have picked up the phone.
Right. That's right.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
So the challenges are many, but one of those, of course, is what is happening along the border. And the border area is not only a BA, but now there is what they call South Kordofan, a region which is occupied by the Nubers. And so in a BA, this is particularly an area which is at the heart, in fact, of Southern belief that it belongs to the South. And it has a long history as to how it reached this particular status. This goes back to 1905, actually, when the Dinka Nok, especially the chief of the Dinka Nok, decided that they were going to be a part of the North. So when the wars went on, I mean, the First Civil War, the Second Civil War, the end of the Second Civil War, of course, is the Addis, what they call the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And in that peace agreement, there is a protocol that allows actually IBA to vote on whether it wants to continue to be a part of the North or to be a part of the South. That was supposed to take place simultaneously when the South was having its referendum on January 9th to the 15th. Now, the Khartoum government, of course, has not allowed that referendum to take place in Abyei. And so that is one of the source of the problems and, in fact, the tension that is right now for conflict over that region. Now, one thing that is clear, of course, is that a good number of leaders, actually, who are leading the SPLM, SPLA, that is the Sudan Liberation Movement in the South and Sudan Liberation Army, come from this region, Abyei. For example, the foreign minister of this new country of South Sudan is from Abyei. And so there is enough support for the Abyei people, basically, to carry out that referendum. That they are demanding that the referendum should be fulfilled as it was signed on.
Now, did the 100,000 people who fled Abyei and fled to South Sudan, will they go back to vote?
If they allow that to the vote to take place, yes, they will go back, actually, because mm-hmm. also the UN is involved in that process. Now, part of the problem about the UN role is that since the Comprehensive Peace Agreement has come to an end as a result of the independence of South Sudan, the Khartoum government is requesting that they leave that region, that is the border region. And I think that is likely to happen. That is why the UN decided that they should send in Ethiopian troops. Ethiopian soldiers, and as you mentioned correctly, there are 4,200 Ethiopian troops. And just recently, again, as you have correctly noted, four killed and seven injured by landmines in Abyei. And so that is again sending, a wrong message actually as to what might happen to the UN. Troops who are largely Ethiopians in that region.
Well, it's almost impossible not to blame the North for that, for at least for planting the landmines. Surely they occupied that town, did they not?
They did. In May, they occupied Abyei. They occupied it, and the United Nations Security Council voted, of course, condemning the occupation. And the UN also demanded that they should withdraw. So the condition for withdrawal was to say we want a force, actually, that will replace them and perhaps be able to protect the citizens or the civilians in Abyei. I think the Ethiopian force has been authorized to use force in order to protect civilians in Abyei.
Again, I'm speaking with Lako Tongan, who was born and raised in South Sudan and is now, which has only recently become a country, and he's a professor at Pitzer College. And you've been active in the liberation movement for South Sudan. This has been a 21-year-long struggle against the North, and you were close to the very charismatic leader, John Garang, who waged this guerrilla war against the North, again, as I mentioned in the opening, the leader of the North has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for genocide, General Omar Bashir. There's been many, many stories, of course, and documented evidence of widespread genocide by the North in Darfur and in the area that they're bombing, where the Nuba live, just recently. But tell us a bit about John Garang, because it was his skill as a guerrilla fighter that finally wore the North down, and they had to make this deal under international pressure. They certainly didn't want to make this deal because they're giving up the fertile and oil-rich part of their country.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. John Garang was a colleague. John Garang, we were refugees together in Uganda in a camp called Bombo, which incidentally, after witnessing the independence, I went to Uganda and went to the refugee camp, which is now actually, that camp is now a military barracks for the Ugandan army. But John Garang, we were together here in the United States before he went and joined the guerrilla movement of the First Civil War. That was the First Civil War from 1955 to 1972. It was towards the end of that war that John Garang, actually after he finished his college at Grinnell College, decided to go and join the guerrilla force. It was called Anyanya. Now, John Garang, I think, was able to develop new ideas about how to view the problem of South Sudan. Let me put it that way, the problem of South Sudan. That is how the North, actually, Northern elites were looking at the problem, that it was a problem of Southern Sudan, sometimes referred to as the Southern problem. John Garang reversed that argument and said, it is a problem of the Sudan as a whole. That is why he formed the Sudan People's Liberation Army, Sudan People's Liberation Movement, to distinguish it from Southern Sudan Liberation Movement, which was the the one during the First Civil War. So that argument, I think, changed the character of the Sudanese conflict in the sense that it was able now to include Africans who were in the North. Remember, when we talk about Northern Sudan, we tend to lump together those who identify themselves as Arabs and those who are Africans. So by addressing it as a Sudan problem, he basically framed it as a problem between those who are marginalized, namely those who are in what is referred to now as African peripheries, distinguishing them from those who are along the River Nile in the North who claim themselves to be Arabs. That argument was able to win a vast number of Northern Sudanese who are Africans. The Nubas, the Darfuris, in fact, started their conflict because of what John Garang was arguing. That, in fact, if you look at the Sudan, it is the problem of the Africans who are marginalized versus the Arabs who have been controlling, the Arab elites who have been controlling the government, all the powers of the state since the country became independent in 1956. Mm-hmm. That argument is what made it very difficult for the Khartoum elites, basically.
Well, let me just in the last couple of minutes, get to the present situation, because clearly the Khartoum government had to agree to this deal, which reluctantly. The oil's in the south, the pipelines are in the north. The Khartoum regime's mismanagement, cronyism, and profligate military spending has basically bankrupted them. Mm-hmm. So this is a dangerous government because it's its own people. You know, there's a thing going on around that neighborhood called the Arab Spring, right?
That's right.
So what do you think is going to happen?
The regime is going to have a tough time. Mentioning the issue of the Nuba Mountains.
We've only got about 20 seconds, sorry.
Okay, right. That regime is going to face now conflicts within the North itself. Darfuris, the Nubas, Southern Blue Nile people, and Eastern Sudan, they are working together now to form an alliance, basically to fight Khartoum.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. Lako Tongan, again, Professor of International Intercultural Studies and Political Studies at Peitzer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, where he witnessed its Independence Day firsthand. So what did we learn today on Background Briefing? Well, we went down to New Orleans to speak with Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She, a blueprint of ALEC, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is this corporate manufactured front group that's coordinating all this corporate-friendly legislation in all 50 state houses and in the Capitol. She got a blueprint of ALEC's legislative onslaught of 800 bills, which was leaked to her. So she's down there where their annual conference underway of all these corporate whores gathering in prostitution-friendly New Orleans, the Big Easy. And she was explaining to us how, first of all, it's amazing that this group can exist. It's a non-profit, even though it's received something like $400 million from corporate America, and it's, you know, under the nonprofit rules, you can only educate, you can't advocate, and here they are passing legislation, crafting legislation, getting it through, and taking care of the congressmen or the legislators who get it through. This is the corporatization of American politics in its most naked form. We've already seen the corporatization of the Supreme Court, and this is its ugly twin. It's quite a story. And then we talk with David Ruscio, professor of economics at Notre Dame, about what looks like a kind of gathering perfect storm of an economic calamity. These prominent Wall Streeters have been predicting a double dip recession and cascading municipal bonds, and the bond markets are being slammed in Spain and Italy. So he was able to really put it all together and of course the analogy is with what happened with Smoot Hawley, which was a know-nothing ignoramuses, just like these Tea Party people who dug the hole deeper during the Depression by passing legislation that was based upon economic ignorance. And we made that analogy with what's happening today in the United States Congress, of course, and the difference is that in this case, Obama owns it as much as the Republicans, who claim they got 98% of what they wanted, since they passed it together. They're joined at the hip. And the third segment was with Lako Tongan, who's just back from Southern Sudan. He's native Southern Sudan. He was very close to the guerrilla leader who founded the country, but was mysteriously killed just as the North finally capitulated after 21 years of guerrilla war. Already in this new country, only formed on July the 9th, is having a kind of guerrilla war on its northern border. Ethiopian peacekeepers were just killed, and it does look pretty grim. But he's basically, at the end of the day, thinks it's the northern, the Arab North is the one that's going to collapse through corruption and cronyism and enormous waste of military spending. And it's really a war between black Africans and Arabs. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.